and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Unknown Pod, Bitcoin adjacent podcast. We are glad to have you here. I am joined by a sweet combination of the Island Boys and the Theo Bros. Is that what we're going to call our PCA brothers up in the mountains? What are we going to call you?
Yeah, that works.
That would be a very hefty compliment to lump me into that category.
Okay, yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, I'd say what's that? It's like federally, you're a Theo Bro, like you're under Tim's. You know, that sounds good. Yeah, we like that. Okay. All right. Let's introduce ourselves. My name is Jordan Bush. I'm the executive director of TGFB Media, which exists to help Christians understand and use Bitcoin for the glory of God and the good of people everywhere. Oshawa, go for it.
My name is Oshawa Hawthorne. I'm the founder and director of Brilliance Labs, a faith-driven startup incubator that we help churches and ministries take wild new ideas and make them reality. And we like playing with Bitcoin.
Cool. I'm Ryan Finley. I'm the founder of Tracker, a software company. We build publishing software, and we also have built up a kind of a media wing to that. And got 6 kids, and I love working on projects with them. And
Great. I'm Jim McAndrew. I started Magnolia with Tim Fox to orange pill the church. It's a nonprofit.
I'm Matt Purvis, pastor in Hawaii and business owner, father, hospitality person, sort of farmer, and also into Bitcoin and other tech stuff, what's going on in the future.
Love it. All right. So we are here today to bring you, just to give you an idea of the structure here, what we do is throughout the week or earlier this morning, we find tweets that have been, that we've, you know, benefited from. On any one of a number of levels, whether that's spiritually or, you know, in our life as dads or husbands or just in the Bitcoin realm, everything will broadly touch Bitcoin. That's kind of the broad common theme. But we just basically kind of bring something to the table and we just kind of talk about it. Something that we think will be helpful to people who are out there listening, or something that is challenging, something that's causes problems. We just kind of want to come here and talk about these things with each other and by extension with you. So Ash, you are our producer for today, managing the tweets and sharing them with the audience. So why don't you go ahead and load up tweet number one?
Will do. Matt, you should check the chat. I got a little jab at you. This might be worth investigating. Okay, here it is. This is Jim. This is yours.
Cool, yeah. So this is the Michael Saylor keynote that just dropped yesterday, Bitcoin for Corporations 2025. It was a totally savage keynote. You should definitely watch it if you haven't seen it. One of the things that he said, or one of the charts that he showed, was that 96% of the companies in the S&P 500 can't outperform just buying a T-bill. The only companies that are really doing anything, of course, are the Mag 7. But later on in the presentation, he also talks about his experience with getting 3 minutes to present the corporate Bitcoin strategy to the Microsoft board, and how, you know, obviously it was pretty insulting to just get 3 minutes with them, but then how 99.9% of them voted it down anyways. And then he quoted his own presentation from the previous Bitcoin for Corporations, or maybe it was Bitcoin Prague, where he did 21 rules of Bitcoin, the 11th rule being Bitcoin is restricted for those to those that have a need to know. And so essentially Microsoft's problem and the problem that all the other Mag 7 have is that they essentially make so much money that they're all about reducing volatility to zero. Essentially, they just, you know, they want to re-sign new 3-year contracts with their customers 1 year ahead of time and just do little inflation bumps and include a bunch of software and services that those companies don't need, but they have to, because otherwise you don't get any of our products and services. And so they sort of just are going to perpetuate the status quo. So I think one take that I had, and it's just shocking to be watching this from afar as an entrepreneur, is just how late stage capitalism we are and how many zombie companies are out there, even in the Mag 7. Like the Mag 7 themselves are zombie companies in a sense. And then the next take is just this idea of, like, as an entrepreneur, I always felt kind of hemmed in, like, what's the point of starting a new company? There's no way I'm going to be able to compete with these monopolies, essentially. And I think what's maybe going to be an interesting trend to watch is, since these companies don't have a need to know, there's going to be all these companies at the fringes, like, you know, GameStop and Mara and whatever, that are adopting these Bitcoin strategies that you've never heard of, and they're going to be wildly outperforming these companies. And so there's sort of this decentralized trend or disruption that could potentially happen here. I mean, we all want to see NGU for our own bags that we hold in Bitcoin, but it really has a, in my opinion, a potential to completely upset the sort of reigning oligarchy of what is, you know, the companies in the S&P 500 that have 90% of all the wealth, essentially. So I don't know. What do you guys think?
Good pull, Jim. That is a fantastically articulated point. And yeah, again, it makes me, it's interesting because, I mean, I remember Preston Pish talking about like how he was saying, you're going to have, I mean, Bitcoin makes sense to own right now. And then at some point in the future, you're going to have like this repricing that goes on, and that what you said doesn't necessarily change that, but just like, I wonder how his thinking, you know, if that's how it would be changed, or like, I mean, amplified, I guess, by like thinking of like, if I'm imagining that this is still faster than he's thinking for the majority of companies doing this, like adopting some level of Bitcoin. But yeah, I mean, the fact, yeah, once you start seeing these little companies just by virtue of doing this, it's just crazy. The first mover advantage is real.
Yeah, like it feels like the Mag 7 is like unstoppable.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. And so it's just interesting to envision a world in 5 or 10 years where like none of these companies are relevant.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, the combination of Bitcoin and AI, you know, like now again, yeah. The thing is like, I mean, will that make them more entrenched? The fact that they can do, you know, more with less, or are you still going to have those people? A lot of people who have just been, you know, a lot of people who have cush jobs with Facebook, you know, are they going to get just kicked out because they can, you know, they can do more with like a shoestring crew at Facebook or whatever. And then you're going to have a lot of people moving out into other, you know, other places.
Yeah. I mean, I have friends at Facebook that make over $1 million a year salaries working on their, you know, AI products and stuff. It's insane how much these companies are willing to pay. So, I just, what's interesting is MicroStrategy or Strategy has such a lead at this point that even if these companies did decide to adopt a Bitcoin treasury strategy, it's like them pouring money into Bitcoin is just going to further extend MicroStrategy's lead.
Yeah.
So it's like the game is already over. Like Michael Saylor won. Welcome to your new overlord. He is the richest man in the world.
Yeah. But again, they're still going to win, though, like because like people can be like, oh, well, then I guess it's over with. And it's like, no, they're still going to win relative to other companies who are slower to move. Right. Like there's.
Oh, yeah, for sure. But I just there's just no catching strategy at this point.
Yeah. The only one who's even possible would be Apple. And they would need to deploy like something like, I want to say the math is like 70% of their, or like it might even be more than that now because of the price of Bitcoin recently. But like, yeah, there's no way.
But
like,
even if they did that, wouldn't it pump Saylor's bag so hard that he would just stay ahead of them?
Sure. Well, I don't know. Cause I mean, he's got more cash, or Apple's going to have more cash flow and be able to buy more.
Well, yeah, but while the bags are getting pumped, all of his instruments are going to be able to re-roll that back in while it's going up.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I guess
unless they've been secretly accumulating.
What comes to my mind, and if it's a bunny trail, we can come back. But there's such a similarity to me in terms of technology between AI and Bitcoin. They're very different, but they both rest upon the shoulders of the interconnectivity of the world on the web to very high quality and dispersed compute power, and in the case of AI, to tons and tons of data. And so it's interesting and what you guys think, but it seems like these big companies have jumped on AI like immediately. They see how that will help them. And also there's so much capital needed. I was looking into, is there any way for the little guy to get into like, you know, like you used to be, you could buy an ASIC miner. Can you do that and then rent it out for AI if AI is going to boom? Not an ASIC miner, but another piece of hardware, you know? And based on what I listened to, I'm like, eh, it's going to be the big boys because they're going to deploy massive areas with special cooling and special deals and their own power plants and stuff. So bringing that back around as a response to that, why, I mean, I guess the question is, why are they so clear on the benefits of AI, but they don't see Bitcoin? And I don't know, do you guys see the connection there in terms of the tech of both of those?
Yeah, I think AI is so in everyone's face right now. Like, the CEO of a company can, you know, they can pull up ChatGPT and Grok and Anthropic and start playing with it, and it completely blows their mind in an obvious way in, like, 30 minutes. And where it takes, I mean, from my experience, it can take 6 months for someone of, like, it's actually putting in some time to really get their mind wrapped around the paradigm shift that Bitcoin represents. And so there's just like, yeah. So I would say literally it could be like a 6 month difference to even understand the two different things.
Especially when they're happening at the same time, right. Like it's like AI is much more intuitive because you get the immediate feedback loop. Like you can understand, like, I don't know. There's still feedback loops that you can get with Bitcoin, but I just think like you mentioned, it's so viscerally obvious the you know what you can do with AI and the seemingly the changes in you know radical transformation it's going to have. Whereas Bitcoin, there still are elements to it, but there's things where you have to put in more work to kind of understand all the elements at play. Because like there most of us, and some of it just has to do with kind of where we're coming from. Like there's very few of us, very few people who have like a good grasp on, you know, Austrian economics or, you know, like any of these things, you know, energy or like, you know, a lot of these things, we're just not, it's kind of like, we're kind of not positioned to be able to understand as quickly what Bitcoin's proposition is, especially also holding the reserve currency. Like there's a bunch of things that make, especially for Americans, it make it more, you know, more challenging, you know, to understand than something like AI, which again you can see viscerally. I can see immediately things creating an app in minutes.
I got two takes on that one. One is the big companies see AI as something that they can control if they get to it first, and Bitcoin is something that they can't control, and they don't like that. They want to be in control. And then secondly, this is based on the later part of the Michael Saylor keynote that just dropped. These big companies are volatility optimization mechanisms. They're trying to reduce their volatility as much as possible. And so I think they view AI as a path towards doing that, whereas Bitcoin only increases their volatility. And so it's automatically a magnet towards one versus pushing them away from the other.
Yeah.
And something that you said you brought up from Saylor's talk is this reality that you only get Bitcoin when you need Bitcoin. And thus you only get it when you need it, and then you get it, right? And so the reality is these big companies, they don't need it. And I see the same thing when it comes to the church and nonprofit world, where the slow boiling process of the frog in the pot of inflation and currency debasement and authoritarian strangulation, it's a slow process, and you don't see it until it's too late, until you're going out of business. I just think of all the Christian universities going out of business that have tried all these different things to try to make it work, and government regulation, currency debasement, cost of living, all these things has crept up on them for decades until it's too late. And so it really takes stepping back and starting from a new paradigm to see, okay, Bitcoin is different and I do need it. Mm-hmm. And And yeah, so that's what I'm trying to figure out is how do you convince the frog in the pot that's about to get cooked? You still have time to jump out. Bitcoin is the exit hatch. Take it.
Yeah. Well, putting on my sympathy hat for both the church and also publicly traded corporations seem different, but let me put a commonality. They have to answer to what the people want, because so they have to answer, and that's part of, I think, the in the church case, you can't just say, don't worry, I'm leading you into a wonderful future. The money you donated is going 50% into Bitcoin, and no one knows what Bitcoin is, you know? So the orange pilling has to be sort of a grassroots level, not, yes, pun intended, has to be a grassroots level movement. And same in some senses. I guess there are some radicals out there in terms of publicly traded companies, but for the most part, if your shareholders don't get it, they mostly don't want to follow a brave visionary into an unknown future. They mostly want to keep it, keep the cheddar rolling the way it has been.
And this is, yeah. I like your argument here, Matt, because what you're saying is that Presbyterians are going to be Presbyterians, Roman Catholics, you know, like people who have a hierarchical structure where there's more authority up top are actually potentially better positioned. If you can get one of them on board, they're making, you know, unilateral, not unilateral truly, but like, you know, they're making
leadership,
decisions.
Strong leadership.
Strong leadership. Yeah. Like you see this again, we talked about this in one of the last episodes, but it's fascinating. And I think very good what you see happening with, we should have brought up this tweet too, but it was Stacy or Max or one of those guys talking about how their perspective on politics changed based on being in El Salvador and just seeing, look, they had a democracy and people, it was the worst thing ever because like there was no strong man to basically say, this is wrong. We're shutting this down. We're doing this, you know, like there was not, that's needed. And so I think like that still is a conversation that a lot of people are not willing to have. Is like we value quote unquote democracy and quote unquote the will of the people to a degree that's resulted in a lot of awful things happening is just going to continue to make it worse. So again, I don't think it's not an accident when you see Saylor, like what differentiates the artist formerly known as MicroStrategy from many other companies, it's the control that Saylor had. Mm-hmm. And so like, so if you're a business owner, you actually do exercise this type of, you know, power and control to be able to, you know, help your company opt out. And so that actually can give you paradoxically like a, you know, a David over Goliath, you know, advantage. So
people are kind of, maybe what you're saying in the positive is that the people will rediscover their desire for strong leadership. And that you see that also in Elon, who's doing all kinds of crazy stuff, and he's got a publicly traded company, and he's tweeting things that can get him in trouble. And many corporations would be like, you got to pull that back, but that doesn't happen. And so.
I mean, you see with Trump too, like people want a strong person to get in there and do stuff. And like there obviously are ways in which that can go wrong, but there is much less acknowledgement of the ways in which democracy, you know, can democracy creeping into anarchy and creeping into just lawlessness has been, you know, happening for decades. Like, I just think there's way less awareness in taking seriously of that than there is the theoretical
and what you just described. What you just described, Jordan, goes along with what I thought your intro, Jim, was really powerful in the sense that what you described is timeless. It may be happening now, but it's kind of also timeless. You know, that the people who have got their they've got their gravy train already running. They don't want to disturb that in case it messes up the gravy train. That's a tale as old as time. And what you said, Jordan, politics-wise, we got to the point where we got people curb-stomping folks in the middle of the street with zero consequences.
Consequences, yeah.
And so people will say, I'll take anyone. You know, I use the example when I explain it to my kids. Why is the Taliban in charge in Afghanistan? Yep. Because the Taliban is better than chaos.
Yep.
You can now you have to walk to the grocery store with a member of your household if you're a female, but that's better than not being able to walk to the grocery store at all and not knowing what to expect. You know.
Yeah. I mean, this is you could go to Iraq with Saddam Hussein. Like, this is another thing. It's like, oh, Saddam, he's this bad guy. It's like, yeah, he is a bad guy, but you know what? There's other people who are worse. Like, mm-hmm. there's alternatives to you know, who are demonstrably worse. I mean, you could, I mean, even if you're just thinking about this as a Christian, like the treatment of Christians under ISIS yeah. and the treatment of Christians under the people who just overthrew Bashar al-Assad in Syria, and the people who overthrow Christians pretty much or overthrow, you know, these strongmen wherever they go. Ironically, Christians keep getting the worst end of the stick. And so, again, I just think people are just not, we have zero resources in terms of education or otherwise to be able to have that conversation. And so we're kind of having it on the fly, you know, because people are just recognizing like this. So I can't continue to operate under these.
Speaking of strongmen, that leads us to our next topic, which is being ruled by our AI overlords.
Ooh, okay.
So Paul Tudor Jones was on CNBC, and he said some pretty crazy things that I've heard and thought before, but to hear them said out loud in public, basically he says, it's going to take an accident where 50 to 100 million people die to make the world take the threat of this seriously. And he says, I'm buying 100 acres in the Midwest, cattle and chickens. So here you have this billionaire going full-on prepper.
Hold on. Because so just to clarify, he is speaking about an event that he was at with some of the largest, some of the like the top like top five AI companies, their first or maybe it was the top four AI companies, their top five guys from each of those companies. And this is a quote from one of the guys who is working for one of the AI companies, was basically okay. saying like it was something like this, and I'm pretty sure he was the one who was buying 100 acres in the Midwest. It wasn't Paul.
The first sentence. Yeah.
Got it. Okay. So then, and I'm gonna bring us to this bolded point right here,
yeah.
where he says the competitive dynamic is so intense among the companies, and then geopolitically between Russia and China, that there's no agency, no ability to stop and say, maybe we should think about what we're actually creating and building here. Okay, so this is the argument that the AI arms race to create this artificial general intelligence, to create the superbot that knows everything and can solve every problem, the competitive arms race is so great that anyone who decides to like have a conscience and have a like think about whether you should do it, not just that you can do it, there's no time for that. Mm-hmm. You're racing like NASCAR to the finish line, and there's just no stopping until like what will it take? Well, okay, it's a atomic bomb
extinction level event
that will finally make all the powers that be say, oh, maybe we should rethink this.
Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is, I'm not even sure, will that stop people? Because at least with nuclear weapons, it kind of like there actually was, in a sense, kind of a finish line where it's like, okay, we just cross the threshold, and they're all of a sudden they're in the club. And but with the AI stuff, I'm not sure if there's going to be a stopping, right? Because they're just going to keep pushing to make it more and more advanced, more and more competent.
I got to bounce, guys, but I'll give you a quick take. So first take is, I don't know why it takes 50 to 100 million people to die. I think 10,000 people dying or even 1,000 people dying at the hands of AI, people would have no appetite for that. We've seen too many movies like the Terminator. This is Matrix. Like it's people are their hair is already standing on its end. Right. Okay. So secondly, there's no stopping it. Like it's yes, this is the direction the world is going. There's no amount of government regulation or browbeating or convincing people to be ethical or whatever. Anyways, I think that it's likely. When I say that, I mean technically possible. It's likely that it's technically possible, but I don't think that God will allow it. So that's my quick take. When I say don't think God will allow it, I'm talking like this is the second Tower of Babel kind of moment. Like God smotes us before it happens kind of thing.
So God kills the 50 to a million, 100 million people first?
No. Like, he doesn't let the technology get to the point where it would wipe out humanity, because that's not what his plan is for the end of humanity. The plan for the end of humanity is Jesus coming back and there being Christians alive when that happens.
Yeah.
So we know the end of the story, unless you're talking about like some version where AI wipes out 99% of people, but then like somehow the grid goes down and AI doesn't survive. And then we're like scratching and clawing our way back from hunter gatherer society again. I mean, I guess maybe there's some version of that, but you know, to me, it's like if the AI really is what we think it is, then, you know, I don't really see why it only takes out part of us. Like, it takes out all of us, and it doesn't take itself out in the process because it's smarter. That's the whole point. It's smarter than us. So it's like we all die. It keeps living. That obviously doesn't line up with the Bible.
Other takes? You're muted.
Yeah, he's muted. All right. See you guys. Thank you.
Jim.
Jim's out. Jim, mic drop, out. Yeah, no, I do think that this is a helpful thing to just think about as Christians, where it's like, yeah, that's not how the story ends. Now, again, that doesn't mean that you don't get some sort of, you know, Hiroshima Nagasaki thing. Like, obviously, nuclear weapons exist. They've been used. You've had, you know, hundreds of thousands of people die. How many people died in Nagasaki?
Yeah, it was like Hiroshima. 250 or something.
See, that just seems like it should be more, but not that it should be more, but that it would be more. But yeah, so I think that you absolutely can have these, you know, big events that kill a lot of people. But in terms of, yeah, in terms of extinction level event, I think that is something that, you know, as Christians, like we can take, we don't freak out on that level. But yeah, I just think it is. Yeah. It is a freaky world.
The world is more anti-fragile than we believe and that we know. And it's ultimately because God is anti-fragile.
Yeah.
You know, I would say these things can happen. There's no reason to... but I actually... It'd be interesting for them to flesh it out. Is it like a drone swarm? Is it like another disease? It could be... I guess it could be anything. That's why they left it generic. But we have to balance... Number one, we always have a super dangerous boogeyman, no matter what it is.
Yeah,
it was terrorism in the early 2000s.
Correct.
It transforms into whatever the next thing is.
It was scarcity.
Even China. I'm not even trying to change the subject. I'm just saying now we have a dragon, you know, that we're afraid of, and most of the time. Those boogeymen are not what they seem. I think it's a physiological thing that we. I've heard Naval say it like, if you think you saw a tiger in the bushes 1,000 times and you were wrong, but then one time you were right, the tiger eats you that day. You know, so we're always looking for like physiologically what's about to kill me, and most of the time we're wrong. You know. It doesn't mean it's impossible, but the safety features grow at this, to work out alongside the new technology, and then of course Jim's point being that the Lord's plan, it's a dangerous thing to. It's true, I agree, I accept all that, but it's a dangerous thing to try and figure out exactly the order of how it's all going to happen. You know, which Jim wasn't doing that, by the way. I'm not talking behind his back about that. I'm just saying, for Christians, we have to say, it was hard to understand how the Christ was going to come the first time when you were there, and it's hard to understand how he's going to come the second time. And we have to stay humble about that.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely key to put Christ at the center of this conversation. I mean, I've listened to some podcasts, whether it's the Social Dilemma guy, when he did his Joe Rogan appearance the second time, where he talked all about AI safety and the dangers of AI. I remember another podcast with some of these crypto guys. I don't know if it was Blockless or I forget their name, but they had this OG AI safety technologist, PhD dude, that just basically broke it down. All the ways that AI is going to kill us and how likely it actually is. It's a really in-depth, compelling podcast. But you have this atheist, secularist, crypto bro that's listening to this, and he's like having a mental breakdown and this crisis of reality as he's listening to this, because he's realizing I have no hope for the future. Yeah. You've just convinced me that I'm going to die a horrible death at the hands of Skynet, and I don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
Well, and this is, I mean, it gets at what Jim was saying, where, again, ironically, the institutions like AI better than Bitcoin because they can control it, or at least they think they can. Yeah. And so this idea of things that you can control being more valuable or, you know, or like more desirable than the things you can't is, I mean, like, well, it's just bad reasoning. Cause like, mm-hmm. I mean, so many things, like we don't control, like the maximally important things to sustain human existence are things that are completely outside of your control. Like we don't control the sun turning on. We don't control oxygen. We don't control, you know, like crops growing. We don't control, I mean, we to a degree, I guess, with that one we do. But there's lots of, we don't make our hearts beat. We don't make our lungs pump. Like everything that's most fundamental to who you are, you don't have control over. You don't choose your parents. You don't choose, you know, like all of these things. And so it's just a flawed understanding of reality to, you know, to put all of your hope and certainty in your ability to control.
And by the way, I think everything. It was less than 4 years ago that we got the CIA unredacted, that the military has almost daily interactions with unidentified flying objects, renamed a more boring name. What's that called again? Mm-hmm. UAPs. Mm-hmm. And that they have also like somehow hovered over nuclear facilities and like shut them down and stuff. I didn't dig into the papers, but this is all the stuff that came out of them, you know. So I'm not saying that to change the topic. I'm just saying, you know, Nassim Taleb's description of we think we live in mediocristan, but we actually live in extremistan in our world. And we're trying to fool ourselves that we have control, but we have absolutely no control. And I only bring up the UAPs to say I don't think that could be fakeable, personally. I don't think it could be like a CIA operation where like tens of thousands of reports are filed by all these normal military people and stuff. I think it's something. And so we just kind of put that to the background now. That was boogeyman for like 15 minutes. Now we're back on to, you know, our new boogeyman. So we have to balance the reality that it could happen with the fact that we are always living in extremistan.
I think go ahead, Ryan. You're good.
I was just going to say that I also think there's definitely a significant component of time preference for these companies when they, you know, low time preferences, they're going to be looking way off into the future and trying to decide what is the best use of their capital for decades out into the future. And I don't think they're doing that. I mean, I think a lot of companies are optimizing for the next quarter or the next earnings report. And so AI has that more immediate impact on things like that, in my opinion.
Well, and another frame I'll throw in there that agrees with you, Ryan, is, and I just thought of this way of thinking of it now, is Bitcoin is really like how you save and maybe, if God wills, the future of trading and money and things like that. But AI is how you earn, in a sense. So they can look at their business and say, oh, I could use this right now.
Yeah.
I've got somebody who costs 10 times, more like 100 times this much, and does half the work that this agent can do, AI agent, in one particular thing. And so they can plug that in and say, that's earnings right there. And maybe the difference in thought pattern is like Bitcoin is for saving at this point, mostly. It can do a lot more than that. But AI, you can just totally go, I could plug this in tomorrow.
Yeah. And how not to lose that which you've already earned. And just quick side note, I just got out of a meeting and we were talking about some philanthropic work, some nonprofit projects, and nonprofits right now, I would say universally in the United States, are going through this crazy situation where projects that they like to do usually they can take years to pull off, right? And so you're like, oh, it's going to cost $500,000. All right, let's start raising the money. And then like a couple years has now gone by, and guess what? The project's not $500,000 anymore. It's now $750,000. Yeah. And they're literally all simultaneously, like, they're all getting crushed by monetary debasement. And there's going to be an incredible opportunity for educating nonprofits who are, like, literally all trying to figure out how in the world do we come up with that couple hundred thousand dollars now that this is over budget because construction costs just blew up and the materials costs just went up. And I'm seeing it like it's literally every day I'm seeing that now. So,
and eventually, I was doing a project in 2020 when it was like what 20% a year or something like that, maybe more.
Yeah. And yeah. Go ahead, Jordan. I'm sorry.
No, you're good, man. It's good stuff. I think the other thing, just the horrifying, I mean, the philosophy major in me just wants to throw it through a wall, is basically saying the whole thing where they're saying we don't have time. We don't have time to actually think about what we're doing and the consequences. We're just going to we're going to go headlong into the abyss, potentially, killing ourselves in the name of, not falling behind. And so I just think like this whole idea of there's this idea of urgency driving action, like the tyranny of the urgent. Like you can do this in your own your own individual level, where you've got stuff that you need to get done, like for your long term sustainability. And if you're not careful to give that priority, then like there's always going to be daily urgent things that are that are important, that seem important. And so your ability to distinguish and think clearly about like what actually do I need to give my time to, so that I'm not just being thrown to and fro by every little thing that says that it's super important, is really, it's a really important thing to do. And so I think like we have a culture that doesn't value truth very highly. Yeah. And like right now you're pitting like the urgency over truth. They're saying, hey, it doesn't matter. We don't have time to think about what's true and what, what's good and what's beautiful. None of those things. We just have to figure this out. We have to pour all this kind of investment, all of these resources, just give ourselves and our cultures and all these things over to this thing because of what might happen. Ryan shared in the chat here, Proverbs 21:5. It says the plans of the diligent will surely lead to abundance, but everyone who is hasty only comes to poverty. I just think, it is in some ways, honestly, this is an act of faith, right? Like in some ways, it's always going to take more time to figure out what God thinks about a subject than what you think about a subject or what other people think about it. And so like there's a real sense in which it's an act of faith to take your time, and it's an act of faith to not just make actions based on, intuition.
Or fear.
Yeah. Or fear. Exactly. Yep. 100%.
Which is whenever fear gets injected into, the process, like it literally immediately clouds our thinking and you're not thinking straight from then on.
Yep.
Like you just start making stupid mistakes. You overlook things that you really already know. Yeah, that's why, like, you got to get that. You got to cast that out and, like, calm yourself down. Trust the Lord and pray for a clear head when making decisions.
I feel like I'm a case study of that right now. I kind of know what I'm where I'm trying to go in all this, but I'm so in deep with work that I don't have a lot of time for it. So I'm really sympathetic to it because that's not my entire life, but that's kind of my life right now. I was going to say what I feel like is a tie into this, too, is when I read the book, what's the one about the 2008 crash? Michael.
Big Short.
Big Short.
Yeah, Big Short. So I feel like that book and some others, he really reveals that the people at the top in these companies, like JP Morgan or all these companies, I think you could say that the majority didn't know what was going on. And that's super important because at least he paints them in a sympathetic light, and it makes sense to me that many of them, it's like they're making their money. They know, they're assuming it's legal. And in the end, what happened? They all got bailed out. So essentially, by de facto, it was legal, to be ignorant about the bigger picture and just to be doing your little narrow thing. So if you're a single cog in that wheel, you're just charging. You're getting an awesome paycheck. Somebody says, hey, don't you understand that these C-minus like loans don't add up to being B-plus loans just because you stack them all together? It's like, oh, there'll never be anything that ever makes them all fail at once. And then when it does, nothing happens to you. So, but my point is, it's not necessarily evil. It's willful ignorance. It's being busy about your business and not looking at the big picture. It's that there's no incentive to look at the big picture because it might reveal that what you're doing is actually harmful. And you, at the end of the day, you get to go home with all your money. So why would you investigate the big picture?
Well, and there were, right? There were regulators. Like, there were people who it was their job. Like, they are getting paid money to keep these guys accountable. But in The Big Short, like in the movie, there's the scene where it's the woman who she's just basically like, listen, guys, if we don't give them the information, if we don't give them the approval that they want, they'll go down and they'll get it from another approval agency. And so it's like one of these things where you're only as strong as your weakest link. Like, you're only as strong as your most moral person. And again, this actually is a perfect segue into the next conversation. Like, go ahead, Ash.
Yeah. So I'll share it. And I just want to say, you guys should retweet the live feed. And if someone's listening to us and they're benefiting from this conversation, please give us a retweet. We love more people to be able to listen in.
Like, subscribe, retweet. That'd be great. But yeah, this is one of these things where we do not appreciate the role that morality and moral decision-making, the importance of it. We do not appreciate that at all. We have completely gone away from that. And so this is another perfect example of this, where, again, in that case that we just talked about, the regulators just needed to have moral fortitude to basically say, hey, we don't care. We're going to tell the truth, even if it costs our bottom line. And because they weren't willing to do that, this insanity was unable to continue in the case of the 2008 financial crisis. And to come into this event, this is we're going to touch on the whole op return debacle debate. So we talked about this last week some. We kind of outlined what it is, so I'm not going to go into that right now. But Jameson Lopp, former guest on the TGFB podcast, go listen to that episode. But he basically tweeted this today. He said, op return debate is novel due to how factions are split. Number one, ruthlessly rational technical folks who understand the dynamics of the network and don't want to play unending subjective games. Okay, and then that's one group. He's obviously more sympathetic to that group, and he's putting himself in that group. And then number two, you have ideological folks upset by how others use the network, and who want to play those games. Okay, so you have the rational, the pragmatic folks on one side, and you have the ideological folks on the other side. Now, like, first of all, that framing. It just hurts my head, again, as a philosophy major, to think about, like, everyone is ideological. Every single person is ideological. You have an ideology that is grounded in something. It's either grounded in reality or it's not. And obviously there needs to be pragmatic or, you know, like actual physical, you know, like fleshing out of these things. No one's saying that's not important, but it's
theology is application.
Correct. It's not sufficient, and I'll give you an example of this. Okay, so here's the example. Okay, so what Jameson Lopp is saying is basically, at the end of the day, it's just about economics. It's just about maximizing the amount of money that you can, and he's basically arguing that economies are always going to they're always going to go towards the maximum amount of money that can be made in a system. It's no use arguing or fighting against this. We might as well just give ourselves over to it. We might as well run headlong into this and just embrace this reality. And now, this is a horrifying ideology in 100 ways, but I'll give you two. Okay, my family right now. I could whore out my wife, okay, to a whole bunch of evil men for lots of money, okay? I am not maximizing the amount of dollars that the Bush family could make because I'm unwilling to whore out my wife and whore out my children, okay? I could make a lot more money, but the reality is that there's other, like, the life and health of my family is about more than, there's more factors involved than simply the accumulation of a certain amount of money.
And life is more than money, it is written somewhere.
Exactly. And Paul, the Apostle Paul, talks about this. Like, he's like, instruct the rich of this age, basically to not to hope in the uncertainty of riches, but to grab hold, basically to, by faith, grab hold of that which is truly life. And so again, Jameson is falling into, like, awful reasoning because he underestimates the value of good reasoning. And so, again, this is one of these things where you denigrate or downplay the importance of ideology and downplay the importance of consistent thinking and of thinking more than pragmatically, you end up making this kind of decision. So we couldn't ask for a better example of this. And then Steve Barber, semi-friend of the program, we appreciate what Steve and Upstream Digital are doing. And Adam as well, so shout out to those guys. But Steve then, he answers that and says, what defines a financial transaction anyhow? Nobody seems to offer a clear definition, let alone agree on a definition. Not sure how a debate can be productive if people can't even clarify this definition and agree to it, okay? Mm-hmm. So basically what he's saying is, you know, really, how do we agree, or like, how do we define what a financial transaction is? And so this immediately, the thing that came to mind, and then Jameson obviously says, ding, 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 this is what he agrees. So it's basically all subjective. And so the very first thing that came to mind is this is exactly the same kind of argument that pedophiles use to try to argue, or pedophiles and people who are apologists for the porn industry try to make, to basically, argue against people who would want to put limitations on the legality of porn. They go, well, what is porn anyhow? Like, really, what is it? You know, the fact that it might be a little bit more difficult, it might be challenging to come up with a definition of this means that we shouldn't even just argue about it. We shouldn't have put any kind of restrictions on this at all. And really, again, this is pure cope from people who stand to make a living, who are making tons of money off of things like porn, and in Jameson's case, making money off of, again, he's investing in companies that are going to be able to make money off of, and putting things on the blockchain. So again, this is something that these are not objective actors who are just out here making these arguments out of the goodness of their hearts. Like, they're out here making things, like, they have reasons. There's money to be made by making these arguments that they're making, and they're actively allied with people who are trying to make money with these things. Now, again, am I saying that Jameson is an awful actor who's trying to? No, I don't think. I think he's basically saying, hey, this isn't that big of a deal, okay? And that type of argumentation, that it's just death by a million cuts, is it's not that big of a deal. You can, this is true spiritually of you as an individual. It's true of denominations. It's true of lots of things. If you're propulsive argument is this isn't that big of a deal, that's not going to lead to a good place. You know, you want to have an active place, an idea and reality that you're moving to. Like, you want to have that. And if you don't have that positive vision, then you're just going to get exactly what is happening and going to happen. It's not difficult to see happening with the opportune debate.
It's interesting that as Jameson goes on, He in a way uses that same porn analogy, because there's that legal definition. You know it when you see it.
Yep.
I think that's literally the legal definition. Like, that's finally what the courts had to come to.
Yep.
It is subjective.
Yes.
But it's clear, and that a reasonable person, when they encounter it, will know when they've encountered it.
Yes.
And so this idea, there is a playing of objectivity, of rationality, versus subjectivity, and they're calling them games, as though a moral standard or an ethical principle is necessarily subjective.
Yes.
And your rationality is necessarily objective and non-emotional and without conflicts of interest. It's a word game.
Epistemological game too. Who told you rationality was the most important thing? Rationality.
Exactly. You're depending on a moral reasoning framework that you can't account for. What was the other thing I was going to say? I can't think of what
I would welcome say. A brief description of what the debate is, because we haven't talked about that here, and someone like myself or others might not know the sides.
It short.
Very short. Yeah, so basically you have one side who's basically saying, hey, the fact that you can include like random information. So when you send a Bitcoin transaction, you can include via the OPRETURN function, you can put data in. So you can include, like we did this, ironically, we did this when we founded TGFB, okay? Like we basically founded, we put in the small message, it's like infinitesimally sized, and basically said, hey, TGFB founded on this day and this time, whatever. And so you can, the fact, so that's something that exists, you can do that. And that, you know, nobody has an issue with that being there, and it doesn't cause, it's not a big deal. Now, the question is, there's people who want to increase that OPRETURN size so that you can put larger amounts of information in there. And so the argument for, well, the argument for this is, look, you're already allowing some information in there, so why not make it more information? And then the other argument with that, accompanying that is, well, listen, at some point, there's going to be, you know, the blocks are going to be full of transactions. And so, you know, we might as well, it's not, shouldn't be a big deal, the fact that we're doing it right now with things that, you know, aren't even relevant transactions. The problem with this is as horrible of an argument as those who would just basically say, hey, you're eating, when you eat strawberries, there's sugar in those strawberries. So by what grounds do you then object to the idea of just eating just the, you know, all of these, you know, these what do you call it? Like kids cereals, like, you know, you're still, if you eat any strawberries, if you object to kids cereal because it's so sugary and you eat strawberries, you're actually being a hypocrite because there's sugar in those strawberries. It's like, no, there is a carrying capacity for that your body is able to process when it comes to sugar. Yeah. And there is a medium there where it stops being, where your body stops being able to use and operate the way that it was designed to function because of what you're putting into it. Mm-hmm. And so the people on the other side, AKA those who are using the right way, are basically saying, like, yeah, no, they're acknowledging this reality. And they're saying, hey, look, by introducing all of this garbage, you're basically forcing people who are running nodes to basically serve as file storage for a lot of these worthless pictures and JPEGs that are being put on the blockchain. And so you're forcing, you're basically hampering the ability for the network to operate the way that it was designed to function. And even if it's not happening today at the same degree that it will in the future, this is not a good precedent to set. It's an obvious precedent that will lead towards, you know, a lot more problems for the network down the road. So that's kind of the cliff notes of what's going on there. And again, I promise you, like, there is not a proactive argument for increasing the block size that doesn't amount to something, at least that I've heard, that doesn't amount to, this is going to happen anyway, it's not that big of a deal. Like, it's crazy. It's just very poor reasoning. And again, like we mentioned, there's a hundred other places. This is the reason why we're talking about this is because this principle is happening in 100 different places in the world right now. And it's just the lack of consistent and good moral reasoning is that it is a pox on all of our houses.
it's interesting because I think the Christian sees the beauty in constraint or restraint. Yes. And is totally fine with it because in 100 or 500 ways in our lives, we are constantly embracing it and we see the goodness of it. Without a Christian framework, you see restraint as a loss of potential or I'm missing out on a happier path. And it's like, no. Well, you know what I mean?
It's freedom.
We need to seek
license.
Wisdom.
Yeah, huh? It's like what you're describing, right? In Christian parlance, it's freedom versus license.
Yeah. Licentiousness, versus freedom, yeah.
You know, freedom is not just doing whatever you feel like doing or whatever you're able to do, which is what Matt, it says you stopped recording. But it's not, freedom is not just doing whatever you're able to do. Like, I'm able
100%.
I'm able to pee my pants. Okay. That doesn't mean that if I were to take up pants peeing on a regular basis, that I'm somehow freer than I was before. Like, this is like, freedom is more complex than just doing whatever you want or doing whatever you're able to do. And so
you and your vivid analogies, Jordan. Yeah.
We make a highlight of the episode and it's all these well, it's crazy.
You know,
crazy.
I don't want to steel man exactly, but to say, I don't want to talk for 10 minutes. So I want us to make it short. To go back to a couple episodes ago, my analogy between gold and Bitcoin being gold is intrinsically gold, but it can be used for many things, including things that are not randomly chosen. Like I've heard Joe Rogan say, we all just decided that this yellow rock was valuable. Wrong, Joe. We didn't all just decide. It has qualities that make it valuable. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be in a sunken ship for 1,000 years and still be gold. So Bitcoin is like that too, and I think this speaks to that question because Satoshi saw it as money, but the underlying tech can be used for other purposes. So if we were going to say, and I have said this in years past, imagine you uploaded the Bible onto the blockchain, and now anyone in the entire world, if they get on Starlink, no matter what country they're in, they can go poof and have access to the Bible anywhere in the world, and no way to stop them except that you can track the transfer. Switching gears, but hopefully it makes sense together. You know, in Isaiah, when he's mocking the idolaters, he talks about, hey, you cut a piece of wood in half, and on this one you baked bread and you fed your family and stuff, and then this other one you shaped into the image of a person, overlaid it with gold or silver, and bowed down to it and you know, worshipped it. And he's mocking him and essentially saying, it was for feeding your family, not for bowing down and worshiping something that has ears but cannot hear and a mouth but cannot speak. So it is a philosophical question of, with blockchain tech, do we have to stay faithful to the money element, or is it okay to say this tech can be used for this, which could include pornography, as you point out, and other negative things? Or is it a split, you know, or is it something in between those things?
Here's another example of this, okay, that I thought of the other day, and I think it's really helpful. So again, the way that you test this thesis, you can test Jameson Lopp's incorrect thesis by basically looking at other transactions, okay? And so here's an example, okay? So imagine you're having a conversation with somebody, okay? And then somebody comes up and they interrupt your conversation. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Mm-hmm. Bad.
The answer is you don't know, okay? Oh. You don't know because they could be interrupting you because your life is in danger or your kid's life is in danger. So you want to leave room for the possibility of interrupting you to happen. But if your conversation is only or primarily interruptions, like if we're just constantly interrupting each other, you're not able to use language as a medium for the purpose and for which it was created to be, you know, used. And so basically, like, you want to have an allowance for something like this to exist, something like OpReturn to exist, because there might be a reason to include a little bit of data into the thing. You might need to, for some purpose. Like, it's good that you make the allowance for it, but you also need a moral framework for argumentation that it has includes self-discipline and restraint that sees the big picture and is working towards facilitating the bigger picture, you know, telos for which language exists. And so I think that, yeah, it's one of these things where it really is important to have both sides of this. You can't just denigrate one side like Jameson is doing. He's basically saying this side of things isn't important. And it's just not true. It demonstrates an ignorance on his part that is you know, putting everybody in danger who is just, you know, blindly going along with this bad argument.
Yeah.
So does this put Satoshi as a potential Christian because of all that, first of all, the fact that he recognized the wickedness of our current financial system and enough to pour an enormous amount of time into creating a better solution, but then also, like, the fact that he did recognize the beauty of scarcity and restraint in the system, like, holy cow, like, this, he either got just spectacularly lucky or he was a very wise person.
Anybody else want to answer that one? Go for it. I've been talking a lot.
So Jordan and I did a whole workshop on this at the Portland Bitcoin is for Everyone conference, and essentially argued that Bitcoin is built on a Christian worldview and has within it certain assumptions that you only come to because either you're deliberately building off of that Christian worldview, or because by an accident of history, you are you're within a Christian civilization that has those values, and you've encoded those into your your essentially the economic policy of your blockchain. So, for example, the idea that you need super powerful encryption to protect your assets. So if everyone is just happy-go-lucky and friendly and aren't going to steal from one another, then you don't need that kind of encryption. That's overkill. But if people are sinners and have a tendency to kill, steal, and destroy, then you need really good encryption. And so Bitcoin is built on an assumption that you cannot trust people not to steal. Now, there's another whole kind of system within the security model of Bitcoin. And Satoshi talks about this in the white paper, about how you deal with dishonest nodes and nodes that are going to try to double spend, are going to try to not steal from you, but fraud you into a fraudulent transaction. And so to have that, to make that programmed into the software, you have to think, well, people will try to steal and they will try to lie to you. How do you protect your system from dishonest nodes? And so there's a whole system of the longest chain and a decentralized kind of talking about the trilemma of the blockchain, an emphasis and a like solving for decentralization and security over the scalability, which is what if you were in the VC kind of build it, move fast and break things type of mindset, you don't solve for the decentralization and security primarily. You solve for scalability, right? Mm-hmm. That's where the money is. That's where the value is. But if you're solving for money that is a neutral currency, as the Austrian economists would describe it, and it actually competes against the global currencies of world powers, you better solve for security and decentralization.
Yeah.
And so absolutely, Satoshi did that. And when you look at the white paper, when you look at the actual how is this thing coded and what problems does it solve for, like you see what it solves and it begs the question, right? And the questions are Christian questions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
View of the problems that we live in.
To on a similar point, humility has layers to it. Okay. So like ultimately at the end of the day, humility, like the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And so like true humility is only found like in like individual people being motivated by like the reality that God has spoken, he's created, he's acted. And so humility submits ourselves as created beings to that reality. At the same time, even somebody like Satoshi, if Satoshi is not a Christian at all, okay, let's say he's not a Christian at all, he still is exercising humility by learning from previous generations and building on what they've built. That takes a humility. Like there's the reality in which a lot of people, if you're just out here looking and trying to create new things and not spending time to learn from the lessons of history, you're going to make a lot of the same mistakes, or you're going to put yourself in a position where you're tempted towards, being driven by intuition and making a lot of the same mistakes. So there, at the very least, there's a sense in which Satoshi was humble because he submitted himself to the lessons of the past and basically set himself. He wanted to build on the previous solutions to these problems. Mm-hmm. It is interesting, right? I've often said that the best argument for Roman Catholicism is that G.K. Chesterton was one. That's one of my arguments. But the perspective of Satoshi being Protestant. Listen, it's definitely a possibility, right? Because you have white paper was published on October 31st, which is the day that Luther published the 95 Theses. The very first Bitcoin block was mined on January 3rd, which is the day that Luther was excommunicated from the Catholic Church. So the day that Satoshi starts a new, you know, basically a new financial system in the world is the day that Luther starts, like, his, you know, initiates this new existence outside of the Roman Catholic Church. Again, there were other ones out there, but again, it's at least poetic. And so it at least leads me to wonder the fact that he calls it the Genesis block. You know, none of these are bulletproof things, just like Chesterton, you know, isn't a bulletproof argument for Roman Catholicism at all. I'm not Roman Catholic, but all of these things, I think it really is. Yeah, I think it really is interesting. It does raise questions, and it provokes conversations that need to happen.
Yeah. Without going over the top, you know, it feels. Let's just say it felt in 2020 or so, divinely ordered. Yeah. I know Bitcoin was before then, and I was aware of it before then, but it did seem divinely ordered that at the very height of the entire world's tyrannical agreement, the governments of the world, tyrannical agreement over all the people of the world, it was right then that it rose into prominence as a freedom technology. Yep. And it was right then that people started saying, this was on all sides, this was way beyond, and it turns out many of the things that it was controlling our speech, controlling our movement, controlling our gathering, controlling all these things. And as I've said before, I sure hope nothing really bad happens in the next 25 years that they really do need to shut things down, because I don't know where you guys all stand, but as I believe the government does have the authority to say, hey, something really big is happening, you know, stay in here, don't get together. I think there is that authority, but it's limited, and it went far, far, far beyond the limits, and if anything really bad does happen, no one's going to listen.
Yeah. And I also think it's like you also see we see it's a pushback, like Proverbs 8:13, the fear of the Lord is the hatred of evil. Our current fiat system is evil. Like it's built on a foundation of theft and stealing what is not rightfully the government's or the Federal Reserve's or whatever.
Incentivizing debt.
Yeah, 100%. And then it builds up, you know, everything built upon it. It's on broken incentives, like Lynn Alden says, it's broken money. And so you see him working on this solution that's not necessarily, it's not necessarily built for the wealthy and the elite and for insiders. Mm-hmm. It was an openly distributed network that anyone in the world could participate in and begin to save in. And so Bitcoin is for the poor. And it's for Bitcoin is for everyone, and then it, you know, as you can see on that Satoshi never touched his coins. He it's like he dropped it off as a gift for the world. You know, I guess we'll see. You know, over the next 100 years or whatever, or 30 or 20 years, whether or not anyone touches his coins. But it's just profound because it's going to go down as one of the greatest.
The second greatest act of sacrifice in human history.
Yeah, because when money is debased, life is stolen. I mean, because it's literally the debasement of human lives, because people are storing their time in currency that then is debased and stolen. And so it's like, but he's enabling millions and millions of people all over the world, tens of millions, to stop that theft. Mm-hmm. And that's an incredible gift. So, anyways.
Yeah, I mean, you guys know this, but not everybody may visualize this. If you save in the fiat system, you are in essence paying off the debt of people who don't save but go into debt, because the inflation is paying their debt off, and the inflation is taking away your savings. So it's not only incentivizing debt, and just to make that practical, if you borrow $1 million and you have normal inflation of 2%, which is not even real, but let's just say 2%, that means that you borrowed that $1 million and in 25 years it's worth half making no payments. So your debt is being paid, and that's why the government does it too. Continuously takes on debt and then pays it down by inflation. So that's I just did that as a picture because I think it's a clear picture in case someone hasn't heard that before. But it's really backwards.
But I mean, that math only works if your income goes up by the actual cost of inflation every year, right? So yeah, your debt has gone down by 50% because the purchasing price of that debt, but that really only works if your income has gone up by that 50%,
right?
To pay it off. Otherwise, if your income stayed the same, no, you still owe the same amount. You've just gotten 50% poorer.
That's true.
And how many of us actually have that amount of increasing income? Well, you know what? If you're living on a Bitcoin standard, your purchasing power has gone up. Hey, so I think we got time for one more, but I'm not sure which direction we want to go. Do we want to keep talking finance, or you guys want to get practical and do some Bitcoin dad kind of husband family type of conversation? Where are you guys at? I know, Matt, you haven't presented one, but we could grab another one from you other guys too.
No, I'm good. I'm up for whatever you guys are.
You got one, or I can throw one our way.
Yeah, why don't you choose, Ash?
Okay, so here you go. So this is from the feminist turned housewife, and it's a thread, okay? And it's about wives and community. So for most of history, motherhood happened in community. Grandmothers, sisters, neighbors, aunts, all nearby, all helping, all part of the child's world. Meals were shared, advice was given. Mm-hmm. You weren't raising babies in isolation. Right. Then came modern life, mobility, privacy, suburbs, careers that scattered families, a culture that values independence over interdependence. Now most mothers are doing this alone. No help, no village, no rest. We weren't made for this. We were never meant to be the cook, the maid, the therapist, the chauffeur, the nurse, the entertainer, and the emotional anchor 24/7 with no break, no backup, and no one to witness the wait. And then we wonder why moms are exhausted, why marriages crumble, why anxiety is skyrocketing, why children feel disconnected, why motherhood feels overwhelming instead of sacred. The answer isn't more self-care. It's real community. Yeah. We need the village back. But not the one filled with daycare centers and disinterested peers. We need the old village, rooted, loyal, multi-generational, the kind that shows up, sits down, and stays. The system failed you, the culture lied you, and the village, it's not gone. It's just at work now because feminism told women their value was anywhere but home. Mm. But tradition knew the truth all along. Mothers were never meant to carry this alone. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's a mouthful. I'll give one quick thought, and I'd love to hear your feedback. And my question I want to answer for myself, and I'd love to hear from you guys, is so how do you create that kind of community to raise the next generation? How do you not have a total burned-out wife? Because you can have a burned-out wife because she's working a 9-to-5 and trying to raise kids and have a family. And you can have a burned out wife if you're not present and she's having a baby every 2 years and just totally like her only mental stimulation and the only person kind of she's trying to do this with is me, myself, and I, and talking to the 2-year-old and figuring things out. And so she feels alone and dad's out of the house being the good provider, right? But all the while his wife is totally at the end of her rope. So how do we balance this? How do we say, yes, kids are a blessing. Let's have a big family. And yes, we want to live off a single income. We want our wives to be able to educate our kids, be present. And yet, how do we have a happy, contented wife, right? And do what this feminist turned housewife is talking about, cultivating a healthy community and collaboration and raising the next generation.
Yeah.
Go.
I'll start. First of all, I would say that the standard pattern or template of life should be that you don't move around all the time. And likely you should consider staying where your family is, where you grew up. And I'm not saying there isn't deviations. I'm a deviation. Well, not really, actually. I was a missionary kid, so I was sort of doing what I grew up. But I say that as a deviation, momentarily, though I've been here 20 years now. The standard should be like, why would you break this? Have a very good reason to break this, because not just you're going to get $15,000 more a year, or 20, or even 100, by moving, you know. Mm-hmm. And that has to do with our influence in our community, evangelism, family, work, freedom, politics, all these things put together. And so in that, I would say that template will allow for saying most likely now you will have grandparents and you will have, God willing, great grandparents, and you'll have a community. You know, it takes a long time for me to vet somebody like you guys. Island Boys know the Krakauer family here, who we've known now for 20 years. So I'll call Robin up. We call Robin up to come help us with stuff, and we trust her with our kids. But I wouldn't trust someone with my kids just because they're in the church. So those things take time to build, and when you have them, it's gold. So as a Christian, I would say pray for it. Pray for those people. I mean, pray that they will come into your life, not just pray for them. Pray that they'll come into your life.
Yeah.
But also that template. And so what I'm trying to do, and I shared a little bit with you guys, I think last time we talked, is promote this to my kids. And I think they're really grasping it. You know, my house, I've divided up into several spaces, and I keep telling the kids, you'll live here and you'll live there, and whoever makes the first grandchild gets to pick which of the four units they stay in, and I'll go in the cabin in the backyard, you know. And a funny story, my 9-year-old Faye has been talking to me. Where I'm at right now is my commercial building, and she's saying, Daddy, I want to buy the land right next to it, because we have a little space for a house thing. And she will not let it go. I want to build a house there, and I want to, you know, this and that. And so the kids get it. They get the vision. Annabelle, who's 13, she's getting it more and more that she'd want to stay. So I'm constantly saying, I'll help you in any way that I can, with business, with a job, with your family. I'll send you on dates with your husband, and I'll watch the kids. And and so I think it's very natural. It's very it's a lost norm. So it makes a lot of sense to kids.
Yep.
It's not hard for them to get.
Dude, so that's huge, thinking. Number one. Is how you set your family and launch your kids so that they stay near you, near grandma and grandpa, and that you add enough value and contribution, and you've cultivated a healthy relationship so they want to be nearby. Right, a lot of kids, they want to get away from mom and dad because it wasn't a place of life and vitality and warmth and welcome and training, and there's not that generosity, right?
Yeah.
So great. Thanks, Matt. What else?
Yeah, I mean, and I was...
No, someone else.
Yeah, okay, fine. I got <No, okay. laughs>
Yeah, I'll jump in. I think the biggest thing is our culture is so long forgotten that this is even a possibility, and or they've never seen it actually in practice. And we came back here to Roseburg, you know, 7 years ago now, and... we have a lot of large families in our church, and there's some doozies where you're just like, dude, like you're so jealous. It's like the entire extended family is just like this network, and they have these massive gatherings, and they're like unlimited aunts and uncles and cousins. And like, you know, it's just, I think the biggest thing is, first of all, see the goodness in it. And, I'll just say something right off the bat. If a husband's gone all day and the wife doesn't have a support network and she's at home literally struggling with like doing those 5 million things and trying to train and discipline the kids and without multi-generational support, it's tough.
Yeah.
It's a super hard job as it is.
Yeah.
But what we've done is we've created this system where we're isolated, and then we just made, oh, it's hard. It is hard. Well, let's make it 5 times harder and have you do it completely by yourself. And so, like,
yeah,
as far as like how can we change that, I think you have to have a vision for it and plan, like you, like us talking about right now, like let's do that and be that for our kids, first of all. Because second of all, I'm not sure it's possible unless your parents catch that vision also and are willing to sacrifice their time and energy to pour in, you know, to be that support network for you instead of going to cruises and things like that. And I'm not saying the cruises are bad, but it's like...
Come on, boomer. Get with the program.
No. I want to be careful there, but there is a lot
you
of
you could
like,
not pay me money to go on a cruise. I just want to throw that out there. I am very anti-cruise, but continue. Go.
Well, I mean, it's just like, what you know, I think our vision of retirement and our vision of like of the later years in our life, that has to change. And if it doesn't change, then you're literally just going to be plotting where to travel and all these kind of things and not how to serve and how to pour into the next generation and how to support your kids. Because there's so much that's not passed on because of it. Yeah.
The thing that I would add to this, I think perfect, like absolutely great points. And adding on to that, I think what you see is you see the generational consequences of disobeying God and of like prioritizing a way of living that doesn't take into account biblical wisdom. And then like the temptation is when you've neglected what God, like the things that God has told you to prioritize, it's then tempting to just look back and be like, look, this isn't sustained. This isn't even possible. So you're like, people are like looking at like, doing like, and I'm not saying this is a thus saith the Lord thing, but in terms of like training your kids in your school and in your home, okay, like training your children, like that is something the scriptures talk about. Okay. That's not in itself an argument.
Are you contrasting it with state indoctrination?
Correct. Yes. Indoctrinating your children at home versus letting strangers and completely people who have no incentive alignment to care for your children. Like if you're doing that, if you're trying to do that in the midst of at a time when for generations you've had the normalization of not doing that, like it's going to be harder for you. Okay, it's just going to, and so it's a similar dynamic to when you read the scriptures, and you see the New Testament is super clear. The Old Testament warns about the danger of debt all over the place, and then the New Testament, the Apostle Paul, I believe multiple times says, "Owe no man anything, except to love one another." Okay. So he talks about debt, and it's in no uncertain terms. Okay, I know plenty of great people who are biblical literalists. Okay, who is listen, the Bible says it, you know, God says it, I believe it, that settles it, whatever. Who, when you get to this verse that talks about owe no man anything, they all of a sudden start becoming, you know, the they're like figurative interpretation.
Jordan, it means make your monthly credit card payment. Come on.
So my point is that because of the decisions to normalize, like the temptation is when you normalize debt and when you literally change the structure of your entire economy to be built upon debt-based money instead of commodity-based, you know, money where it actually has a production cost, then you tempt people to despise biblical wisdom. Like you tempt them to, you marginalize the word of God where it's said, like, so people read, don't owe anybody anything. And they think, well, that's impossible. And so like, so think about like, is that a big deal that you've done something that our culture or, you know, a small group of people, whatever, have done something that leads people to be frustrated with the scriptures and for them to minimize the truthfulness and or importance of the scriptures. Wow. That is a huge deal. It's a very big deal. And so we ought to, this is like the greatest argument for Bitcoin, is we want to move back to a world that's governed by the things and that prioritizes the things that God tells us to prioritize. And Bitcoin does that. And then also that will by extension make things like, you know, homeschooling, and by also implementing things like, you know, taking responsibility for the education of your children, taking responsibility for building generationally and surrounding yourself with family and with people insofar as you can. Obviously, there are imperfect situations, but by prioritizing these things and thinking generationally, you're going to, you know, subsidize more and more of this same, you know, generationally possible thinking.
I just want to say, you might have something to say, Ash, but I just want to say about what you said, Jordan, that, yeah, the vision is really integrated, and that's what it may be difficult to understand if you're hearing this kind of stuff for the first time. And you don't have to eat the whole pie necessarily all at once. Just start with the piece, right?
But correct.
But yeah, I'll give you a fleshed out example of something that I envision. You know, so my parents visited the last week. They were here for the whole week. We put them up in our Airbnb. They, you know, doors open, the kids run over. They sent over like all these board games and all. They spent all this time, took kids to dinner, all this other stuff we got to do together. So they're getting real memories with grandma and grandpa growing up. They visit about twice a year, even though we're in Hawaii, and then we're going to see them this summer too. So that's like a lot of intentionality on my parents' part. Here's how I envision, like, as the kids keep growing older. So the kids were telling me their best friend list today, I think it was. Ryan, one of your kids made the list, one of the top.
When?
I think they might have forgot the Hawthorns because they're so right up there.
We're coming back.
Yeah,
we're
coming back.
This January.
And then, you know, our Canadian friends who are over there in Calgary. And what I'm about to bring in is, so homeschooling, non-government schooling, I envision a, you know, year or two, whatever, in the future of just being like, hey, why don't you go spend a summer in Calgary?
What did my oldest do last summer, Matt?
He came and stayed with us. By the way, she helped. She actually fulfilled. Was she 17? She was 17, right?
17 at the time, yeah.
So, yeah, Abigail came in. She actually fulfilled during that summer what we're talking about right now. She became that auntie who was helping Noel with things and driving our car and stuff like that. And so I envisioned the freedom to say, you know, hey, why don't I help you start this business if it's something you're passionate about? Why don't you go visit some of your close friends? Why don't you go to Roseburg? Why don't you go to Calgary, Portland, whatever it might be? The freedom of saying we're trying to raise you to be a person, not to be an economic unit, you know. And part of that is that kind of stuff, you know. That's why the vision is kind of integrated, you know. And just to close it off, I even had a conversation with my most mild-mannered daughter this last week, where I was like, you know, you may not want to own a business. You know, I'm not saying you can't. I said, I think you'll be.
No.
I said, you might. Can you guys hear me still?
Yeah, now you're back.
Okay. I told her, it's up to you and I'll help you with whatever you want. But, you know, mom and dad put a lot of stress on ourselves. That's due to our kind of personalities. And I said, that may not be your path. You may enjoy just. And I went on with that. And so maybe I'm getting a little far afield. But the point is that I'm trying to make is it's all integrated, you know.
So I got one last point, and then Ryan says he's got to go pretty soon. So maybe I'll give you the famous last words. So I just had a great breakfast, coffee, hangout time with Chris, who's a friend that both Ryan and I know. He's mentored both of us. He's an older gentleman, large family, very successful businessman, church leader. And how many kids did he have? Is it eight?
Eight
kids. How many grandkids do you think he has now?
Oh, man.
50, maybe? I don't know. It's
at least mid-30s and growing.
Yeah. Okay. So 30-plus grandkids.
Wow.
His kids are all walking with the Lord. And so he just has a lot of wisdom in this area and has used this, like, I would say, a biblical model of patronage in his life of how to bless and serve his kids. And so I was telling him about my oldest, who got a really great scholarship for a top-notch Christian university that we're going to be bringing her to this summer. But he looked at me and he said, just watch. Like, she's going to marry someone from the East Coast, and you're going to now have that part of your line, of your godly seed, is going to be somewhere else. And you're going to have no place and influence, or it's going to be very low, and it's going to be a pain to see the grandkids, and you keep sending your kids off to college. They're going to be all over the place. And so he talked about, he had some of his kids went to college, some of his sons in particular, but a lot of his daughters married local guys in the local church or that they met through other contexts. And he said he did everything he could to make it absolutely the most compelling thing for his kids to get married and start families in the city that he lives. And so he's talking about, he's like, dude, talk to that guy that meets your daughter and you let him know, hey, I'll buy you your first house. I'll get you your first job. Yeah. And he's like lining up all the incentives that he's going to set into place to say, this is why you should start your family in our town. And I mean, I thought about that, but it really made a difference thinking through the ramifications. And you have to structure your life plans and it create those incentives for your kids to want to be nearby.
Mm. Amen.
We could talk so much more on this, dude.
Yeah, not being not controlling, but influential. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're controlling, they're going to run the other way. But
and it's being selfish to be able to serve them. Like, I mean, like in a good sense, because if they're gone, you're just like, okay, like, and again, I'm not saying anything about your situation, Matt, but it goes down to that thing. And if you're able to see them a couple times a year, because it travels, you know, it's very expensive and to travel across the entire country. I think it's super wise advice. And it comes down to a vision. Like, what do you want? Do you have a vision for your kids to be able to stay in the community in which you and your wife live so that you could serve them and pour into your grandkids and in that whole next season? And by God's grace, he gave me that guy you're talking about. Chris was one of the most profound impacts on the beginning of my, you know, entrepreneurial life and also raising our kids and disciplining them. Huge impact. But I 100% agree with his with that take. Like, I've literally done everything I possibly could to enable or at least starting my three oldest boys to be able to stay. If they don't learn skills, if they don't learn a trade, if they can't earn a living by the time they're out of high school, the temptation gets ratcheted up like tenfold to leave and go away, go off to college. And so we kind of just, we design things backwards. And by God's grace, the Lord just, and Moses has got an incredible job. He's working remote as a software developer. And
any other big news?
And he met someone local and now they're engaged. So
let's go.
Yeah.
How old is he?
19.
Whoop.
And 19 going on 29. And the Lord is like, it's been awesome.
I think the template should only be broken intentionally. That's what it comes down to. And it's the same. It's the same with marriage and family. Some are called to singleness.
Correct.
Yeah, but very, very, very few. So you should be preparing for marriage.
Yes.
Right. And all your preparation for marriage will help you in your singleness too.
I was going to make this exact same point. I'm so glad you did, because I know I've got a lot of people in my life, and I know we have a lot of people who are yeah budding right now, who are very concerned that we're not thinking about the fact that they're, you know, there's gospel missionaries. Like, what about you know, God sent out Abraham? It's like, yes, he did. Like, no one debates this, but that Abraham wasn't everybody. And like, the vast majority of people in the history of Israel were not Abraham. The vast majority in the people of the church for 2,000 years were not missionaries in the same context as the Apostle Paul was. Right. And so obviously it's not at all to say you shouldn't be willing, okay, to, you know, for the Lord to call your children to go serve him, because they are his ultimate, or he is their ultimate father. You should be willing and be training them for that possibility. But there are norms as well. Like, there are norms in terms of how the church has grown and does grow. And so to completely ignore those realities does nobody any favors. And is part of a big part of the reason why at least the American church is in the situation it is. So dude, man, appreciate you guys. This has been fantastic. Thank you to everyone who's been listening. I do want to mention, we have in about 2.5 weeks, we are going to be out in Vegas. If you are going to be out in Vegas for the Bitcoin conference, we are not doing a full blown TGFB, 2-day conference like we normally do. We basically talked to a number of our core TGFB people who basically, for one reason or the other, said, hey, I really don't want to do a full event out in Vegas. We were actually thrilled about that, because it is actually significantly more expensive to do an event in Vegas than it is to do it in Nashville or Miami even. doing. So we're not going to be doing that, but we are going to be doing a barbecue lunch and networking event. There's going to be a whole bunch of Bitcoiners who are going to be in town. We'd love to see you. You can find out more information at tgfb.com/store or via the pinned tweet on the TGFB Twitter account, which is at ThankGodForBTC. On top of that, if you are in Southern California, I am going to be out in Orange County in, I guess, the end of next week, doing basically an AI and Bitcoin event at Saddleback Church. If you're familiar with Purpose-Driven Life and Rick Warren, all that kind of stuff, he's not there anymore, but they're doing this event, and TGFB got invited to come participate. So I'm going to be representing the Bitcoin side of that equation, and so I'm going to be mentioning some of the things that we talked about at the top of this episode. So if you're going to be around, you can find information about that. I'm going to post that via the Thank God for Bitcoin Twitter account as well. You can find out more information. I can't remember which campus it's on, but you can find that information over there. It's going to be Saturday morning, the 17th. So if you're in the area, would love to see you. Again, guys, appreciate y'all. Ash, you have anything to add?
Nope. This has been rad. Make sure you guys keep your call on so everything uploads after the live call. And I think we should send out like announcement tweets, let people know when we're going to be doing this live.
Yep.
So people can jump on, and we'd love to be able to interact with the audience more as well.
Yep.
So can I make an exhortation to the audience too?
Do
it. There, you know, way at the start of this, we talked about the strong man leadership and promotion of more hierarchical structures and stuff. And it occurred to me, you know, the average church in America is like 50 to 60, 70, something like that. So stuff like this is kind of has potential to be that grassroots movement.
Yep.
Those churches most likely do have a strong leader because those are only a handful of families.
Yep.
They most likely do trust their pastor.
Yep.
So there's the hierarchical and big churches. God loves them. No beef with any of that. But the majority of churches are not big.
Yep.
And so if this kind of information can be spread in a grassroots way, there's already a trust built in those small churches most likely. And there may be the ability to adopt in a grassroots level.
Agreed. Ryan, I'm Matt, good. Ash, appreciate y'all. And we will see you guys on the next episode of To the Unknown Pod.
That's a wrap.
Sounds good. Thanks, guys.